You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Justin Wong takingua. Nō mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā, te rā te kumafa o kohitatea. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire, and welcome back to The Tuesday Wire for a brand new year. And today, of course, rātū the 14th of January. My name is Justin and I will be you for the next hour and possibly the next couple of Tuesdays. And joining me back in studio, fresh back from holiday, is Louis Laws. How are you doing?
Yes, hello. Yes, I'm good, Justin. Very good. How are you?
I am very good. I understand you went to Northern Base during the holidays.
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Do you enjoy it?
It was fantastic. Can't beat the Fat Footies drop. They are fantastic live.
I don't think it'll be much more fantastic than our show.
Oh, mate, are you kidding me?
And FIKNA coming up on the show today. What have you got, Louis?
All right, so I'll be talking with Dr. Peter Thompson about the future of public media broadcasting in New Zealand.
Interesting. And while we are off air for around 3 weeks, a lot has happened overseas and we have two international stories today. First up, I am talking to Dr. Paul Buchanan on the current situation in Iran. And I also talked to two academics about the Taiwan presidential election over the weekend. As always, he aha or whakaro, get in touch with us with any thoughts you have. Tukapatuhimai, you can text us on 53955 or why am I call us in studio on 309-3879. Coming right up.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te Wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
The Middle East since the new year has been in crisis after the US launched a drone strike in Baghdad on the 3rd and killing Qasem Soleimani, an Iranian general in the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, as well as a popular figure in the country. Even though US President Donald Trump justified the decision by saying that the strike was to prevent further attacks on American diplomats and military personnel, the killing of Soleimani caused an uproar in both Iran and Iraq, with the Iraqi parliament in Baghdad voting in favor to expel all foreign troops, while Tehran insisting the attack was a breach of its sovereignty. In retaliation, Iran pulled out of the nuclear deal, and 5 days after the initial strike, they launched missile attacks on US airbases in Iraq. But hours after the strike, an Ukrainian International Airlines flight bound for Kiev crashed after taking off from Tehran, killing all 176 on board, with the majority being Canadian and Iranian. Initially blaming the attack as technical error, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani admitted 3 days later after the crash, the plane has been shot down by an Iranian surface-to-air missile, describing it as an, quote, unforgivable mistake. Now, protests are ongoing against the Iranian government, its supreme leader Ali Khamenei, and the Revolutionary Guards, who were believed to have shot down the plane. Now, what will this current situation in the Middle East change on US foreign policy and regional security against terrorism in the region, especially against the Islamic State? I talked to Paul Buchanan, a former intelligence and defense policy analyst and consultant to the US government security agencies, who specializes in matters of comparative politics, international relations and security. And he is currently the director of the 36th Parallel, a geopolitical risk and strategic assessment consultancy.
Can the regional allies trust the United States to hold firm on its commitments? Because certainly the pullback of U.S. troops from Kurdish-held areas in an explicit deal made with President Erdogan in Turkey that allowed him to then come in to those Turkish areas and basically engage in a policy of ethnic cleansing certainly doesn't augur well for the trust between the United States and other allies in the region. Although the Kurds have always been on the receiving end of betrayal from the United States for years. You know, we have to remember the Kurds have always been the U.S.'s best allies in the conflicts in Iraq, dating back to the Saddam Hussein days. And yet they're continually left in the lurch by the United States because bigger players are involved. And none of the bigger players in the region want the Kurds to have an autonomous, independent state. Which is the bottom line for the Kurds in both Syria and Iraq. And so the United States cuts deals with bigger powers and leaves the Kurds to fend for themselves. But more importantly, the United States has a ring of permanent military bases throughout the Middle East, and they're not going to go anywhere because there are lease agreements with the host countries, and a lot of these agreements are long-term. For example, the agreement to host the U.S. 7th Fleet in Bahrain is on, I believe, a 99-year lease. And so it would be very difficult for the United States to renege on its contractual obligations, nor does it want to in the case of these major fixed assets. But, for example, the relationship between the United States and Iraq in the wake of the assassination of General Soleimani certainly could change. The current U.S. president has said that he wants to withdraw U.S. troops from the Middle East. That betrayed a certain level of ignorance during the campaign, but he now realizes that that'll be easier said than done. And if the Iraqi government decides that they don't want the current U.S. presence in Iraq, then it's very possible that either the Americans will leave, or more likely, they will try to negotiate a new status of forces agreement, the so-called SOFAs, which are the agreements the U.S. has with various host countries, to reduce the U.S. footprint but maintain a presence there for two reasons. One, the fight with ISIS is not over. ISIS is regrouping in Anbar province, that is the Sunni-controlled western province that borders on Syria, into which the ISIS fighters have fled once their caliphate was defeated in Syria. And two, because the United States forces provide a buffer between Sunni-controlled areas of Iraq and Shia-controlled areas, and through the Shia, the Iranian presence in Iraq, which is considerable and is growing as a result of the U.S. intervention, beginning with the ouster of Saddam Hussein, and undoubtedly will grow in the wake of this recent tit-for-tat between the U.S. and Iran, because we must remember, Iraq is a Shia-majority country that was dominated for years by a minority Sunni government in the form of Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party regime. But demographically, the Shia are dominant in that region, and quite frankly, given the history, the modern history of Iraq, the Shia are quite homicidal when it comes to their Sunni counterparts. So the United States provides a buffer in the form of its troops between these two contending factions, and I doubt very much that any Iraqi government, which right now is Shia-dominated, will want to see their country descend into a bloodbath should the United States withdraw, or should Iran enter more visibly into the internal affairs of Iraq. So all of which is to say, the United States cannot be trusted on its shorter-term commitments, but it can be trusted on its longer-term commitments simply because there are more permanent interests at play on the part of the United States and its various host allies. And then there are financial and other obligations that work both ways, which would diminish and make it virtually impossible a quick withdrawal from the U.S. In many places.
And but when we are talking about ISIS now, could ISIS or any other terrorist organizations take advantage of the current situation in Iran or Iraq and will create a resurgence for themselves?
Yes, absolutely, and that's in fact part of what's going on. We have to remember that ISIS originated from the Sunni-controlled areas of Iraq. In fact, their military commanders originally were Saddam Hussein's military commanders, who had fled the Americans, went into the Sunni-controlled areas in Anbar, were protected by tribal chieftains, and then launched a much bigger campaign to gain control of Iraq in the first instance, but later Syria. So that's their homeland, and they've retreated to that homeland. The physical caliphate was defeated by the coalition, but many, many ISIS fighters, including their new commander after the death of al-Baghdadi, have gone into Anbar, where they are receiving the protection of the tribal leadership in many parts of Anbar. And they're reconstituting as part of their campaign to resurrect their conflict, and that conflict is going to begin once again inside Iraq. So there is a very distinct danger that ISIS will reemerge strengthened by any of these conflicts, both between Shia and Sunni in Iraq, but also between the United States and Iran, because when the United States is preoccupied with Iran and is basically saber-rattling at Iran, it is not paying as much attention to the resurgence of ISIS. There are only, although the U.S. is a very, very mighty military power, it still is stretched pretty thin on the ground in Iraq. And so it is quite possible that we'll see a resurgence of ISIS. And if we do, that will exacerbate the sectarian divide within Iraq, which will then will become the epicenter of yet another sectarian war between these extremist Wahhabists and Salafists and everybody else. But we always must remember that the fight that ISIS has taken to the world begins with Shia Islam. The fight is mainly between Sunni and Shia Islam as far as the extremists are concerned. The West is a foil. The West is something that the Wahhabists and Salafists use for recruitment purposes, and they obviously don't want a Western presence in on sacred lands and a region that they consider to be sacred as a whole. And so for them, this has become very convenient in that now they can isolate the fight in the first instance to Iraq along sectarian grounds, which have long historical lineages, and that fight will include a fight against Iran. It poses a serious quandary for the United States, because if ISIS starts attacking Iranian-backed militias in Iraq, militias that the U.S. Has accused of killing U.S. personnel in Iraq and elsewhere, what does the United States do? Does it back ISIS in its campaign against these militias? Or does it try to fight both ISIS and the militias at the same time with a limited amount of troops on the ground in Iraq? And that doesn't seem like a salvageable proposition. So it'll be interesting to see, both diplomatically and militarily, what the United States does, particularly since this is an election year in the United States. And U.S. presidents in general have always used foreign policy to bolster their re-election chances, most unhappily by picking a fight with some very obvious foe in order to rally patriotic sentiment around their re-election. And that's exactly what Trump has done here by picking a fight with Iran that we now know is not justifiable under international law nor American law, because the threat posed by General Soleimani was neither imminent nor as, how could I put it, as grave as the United States initially made it out to be. There was no imminent threat, as it turns out. They just wanted him dead, dead so that they could make a point to the Iranians. And unfortunately, since it was not justified by any imminent military logic, then what it was essentially was a targeted assassination or an extrajudicial killing that is illegal under international law. So the U.S. has, the U.S. president in this instance has engaged in a time-honored practice of picking a fight with a weaker foe during an election year, but the Iranians are smart in that they know that they can't reciprocate in kind, and they have their own troubles to worry about. So everything will remain status quo until November of this year, when the election is held. If Trump wins, we can expect more of the same and possibly an escalation of hostilities with Iran. If Trump loses, then it is very possible that his successor, who would be a Democrat, would recalibrate the U.S. position in the Middle East and possibly begin a drawdown of U.S. troops to let the Iraqis some degree of self-determination, with assurances given that if the Iranians push their influence too far into Iraq, or if they push the sectarian conflicts between Shia and Sunni too far, that the United States will return in order to reestablish that buffer that I mentioned earlier. And it remains open to see what the relationship will be with the Kurds will be, but I would imagine that a successor administration would attempt to bolster the alliance with the Kurds and do something diplomatically to withdraw the Turkish presence, which includes both Turkish troops and Turkish-backed militias in northern Syria and northern Iraq.
The French, for instance, love the cock.
You're tuned into The Wire.
Ko te wai tene maronga BFM, that was Paul Buchanan talking to me about the effects that the current situation in the Middle East has on US foreign policy and regional security. We are having a quick break now. You're on 95 BFM with Justin.
You look different.
Cheers, yeah, I got a new haircut.
No, it's not that. Oh. You're like way hotter.
Okay.
And I respect you more. Also, you look smarter and better at sports.
I mean, I got a B card.
That's it! Yup, the B card.
The B card.
The B card.
It's how you win sick prizes. It's how you get incredible discounts. And it's how you help us stay on a platform for awesome, out there music, hard hitting news, and the odd bit of cheeky nonsense. Sign up for a B card for just $4.20 a month and support independent media. Go to 95bfm.com/sign up.
Wow, what a perfect day for a cool, refreshing Kiwi craft beer. You want something?
Just one of whatever you're getting.
Well, there's heaps to choose from.
I'm easy.
You're easy?
Yeah, I'm easy.
Let's take it slow. Here, we can try it before we buy. Easy, no worries.
I'm not worried.
Get yourself a craft beer education this summer at 16 Ton, where craft beer is as easy as 3, 2, 1. 16 Ton, Jellicoe Street, Wynyard Quarter. Go to 16ton.co.nz or check them out on Instagram and Untapped.
Doctor, doctor, I've been feeling very hot all the time.
Go on.
I'm also incredibly anxious about how I look.
Well, this is very straightforward. I prescribe a Swish News summer wardrobe post-haste.
Not therapy?
Retail therapy.
Refresh your wardrobe this summer at Taddy's Designer Recycle. Take your unwanted summer clothes in now and refill your clothes rack with some breezy new threads. Taddy's Designer Recycle, 161 Ponsonby Road and 47 High Street.
Are you a real doctor?
The beauty of the fleeting and the ephemeral is so last century.
95BFM's popular shows, features and interviews are available as podcasts on RSS and Apple.
It's Totally Wired with me, Danielle.
Two to the left.
On Land of the Good Groove. Got lined up three songs.
Yo, welcome back. It's true.
For stopping by for the 95BFM Kids Show.
Greetings and welcome.
This is the Rhythm Selection.
Never miss out again. Bcasts available on Apple Podcast or RSS for whatever podcatcher you're into.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire, and what have you got for us, Louis?
All right, well, I have a story about the media environment in New Zealand. It's coming under scrutiny, this time concerning public policy, with the government continuing to delay any and all announcements concerning policy. The future is looking unclear for public media and its intentions. It seems the public sector's media institutions are being kept tightly under wraps. While there was a leaked merger reincorporating RNZ with Television New Zealand, it remains unclear which direction the government is choosing. And now even for the private media companies such as MediaWorks selling their flagship channel TV3, we have to find some middle ground in accommodating both commercial and public sectors. The Better Place Media Trust is an organisation concerned with improving the quality of public media and its platforms in New Zealand. They're disappointed with the government's delays and they believe revitalisation is needed within the public media sector and taking measures to increase stability, sustainability and competitiveness in the media sphere. I spoke with Peter Thompson, Senior Lecturer at Wellington's Victoria University and Better Public Media Trust's chairperson, about the state of public media today.
New Zealand has one of the most deregulated media environments, really anywhere in the developed world. I would say that we have a very light touch approach to regulating our media environment. We have minimal provisions for public service media compared to other countries, for example, in Europe, North America. And as a result, we've tended to let the market really be the driver of the way that our media operators In effect, what we've done is we've allowed the market to be the main driver of how our media system has evolved, really, over the last 30 years. And as a result, there's always the government's always playing catch up when it comes to trying to implement public media provisions.
Yeah, it's interesting how you say that about the private sector as well. Kind of the market has been really kind of the main content of what we consume. You know, this kind of foreign owned or produced overseas is what we kind of get fed for information, and it normally comes through one or two or so media conglomerates that are dominating the landscape. So, what do you think are some of the issues with this lack of competition within the media sphere being essentially a duopoly? How could it be a bit more sustainable?
Well, that's a very good question. I think part of this is a structural problem in New Zealand. Because we're a very small country with only 4.8 million people, what we tend to see is that most of our media sectors are dominated by a couple of large players. So, for example, within television, obviously there's MediaWorks, TVNZ, with Sky TV and the pay sector. In telecommunications, you've got Vodafone and Spark are the dominant players. You know, in newspapers, NZME and Fairfax, or they're trying to become a single player once more. So I think there's an expectation, I think, within the media environment that we tolerate a relatively high level of concentration that other countries would find problematic. So to mitigate against that, particularly given the pressures of convergence and consolidation across the media sector, I think there's actually a growing need for the provision of more public media. And it sounds rather paradoxical, I guess, for those that say, well, you know, everything's digital, everything's online, you can get whatever you want at the touch of a button. And the truth of the matter is that that's not really correct if you're looking for high-quality New Zealand content across a full range of genres. So I think the government has to play a much bigger role in the media ecology than it has done historically. In regard to MediaWorks, it's still hard to see who is going to buy it. There's been some speculation about Australian investors coming in, perhaps even one of the New Zealand companies taking it over.
Yeah.
But it's a difficult ask. I mean, the fact that they've self-advertised, you know, their difficulties, I think will make any potential purchaser very cautious about jumping into a free-to-air television market that's under significant pressure. Now, I would have to say I don't think that pressure has necessarily come primarily from TVNZ, as TV3 has suggested. I think most of the pressure has come from the fact that the advertising market has been fundamentally reshaped by the rise of the digital intermediaries.
Mm-hmm.
So any new investor that comes in and takes on TV3 or Bravo or any of the other MediaWorks channels is going to be left with a pretty difficult uphill struggle. I mean, TVNZ is a strong competitor, but unless it's got the backing to develop original local content or to procure high-quality premium genres such as movies, dramas, or live sports, it's very, very difficult to compete against the premium content providers, the new digital services like Netflix and of course Sky. So I think there is a way for the TV market to sustain itself, but it's going to need public subsidy to maintain local content. But any new competitor that wants to come in and acquire TV3 is going to have to think very carefully about the market they're going into, not least because we don't know at the moment exactly what the government's plans for TVNZ and RNZ might be. And that will obviously have some bearing on the shape of the broadcasting ecology.
Now, you mentioned the RNZ and TVNZ about the talks of a potential merger. I was going to ask about this disestablishment to create a new public media entity. If they went in this direction with the future of public broadcasting in New Zealand, what are your thoughts on that potential merger happening?
First of all, I would say that we don't know for sure that it would be a merger in the common sense of the term.
I see. Yeah.
That it would become a single entity with an internally merged operation. I think that would actually be very problematic, because of course RNZ is a public service broadcaster with a charter, and TVNZ is a Crown company, but it's been really operating in a full commercial capacity since the TVNZ charter was rescinded in 2011. So their internal cultures are very different, and I think it would be quite complicated to bolt the two together and expect them to completely fuse and operate in a consistent manner. You know, if that's the plan, I would foresee problems ahead. I think it's far more likely that the government will be seeking cost effectiveness in terms of sharing some resources, maybe sharing studio spaces, maybe some common administrative and management structures. So I think there would be ways in which they can cooperate, but I think you'd have to keep separate the public service functions of RNZ from the currently commercial functions of TVNZ. Now, whether there's something in the middle, a public service TV station that's been mentioned in Labour's manifesto back in 2017, we just don't know. And so there's a lot of questions about the possible impact of this merger on the rest of the ecology. But until we actually know the specifics, it's very, very hard to second guess what the impact will be.
Yeah, like you say, we really don't have anything concrete or solid yet. And with these delays continuing to happen, with the government, you know, announcing its future public media policies, what do you think this says about the media initiatives in general?
Well, I think the government's got to take some responsibility for not progressing these plans further. I mean, they're coming in, into the third year. There's an election later this year, and really, in terms of public media, they've got nothing to show for it. Now, they might say, "Well, we had some hiccups. We lost the First Minister Claire Curran. The new minister's taken time to come up to speed." But I think it's also been complicated by the coalition arrangements, and certainly Winston Peters suggesting that he favours interventions that don't affect the commercial market, and he wants to push forward on creating an environment in which the NZME Fairfax merger could go ahead, was probably unhelpful in this sense, because what I think it's done is it's put a pressure on the government to quarantine its interventions in the public sector in such a way that it won't have any impact on the commercial sector. And that's been going on a long time, I have to say. Previous governments have taken a similar approach, that they're happy to intervene in terms of the government-owned agencies, but they won't do anything to regulate or have an impact on the private sector. And I think this is potentially problematic, because we need a strong public service environment, particularly because there's an acceleration of market failures, in my view, largely attributable to some of the developments in the commercial sector, notably the capture of advertising revenues by the digital intermediaries like Facebook and Google. And I think the government needs to look at a much broader scope of regulatory interventions, not only in the public sector, but also in the private sector, and particularly with those digital intermediaries in mind. So if the government isn't willing to go there, then I'm afraid its interventions may not actually have the effect that they desire.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
That was Louis Laws talking to Peter Thompson of Victoria University about the lack of government media policy. Thanks, Louis, for that. We will be back in a minute.
Party boy. Everybody loves you while they do. Yeah, they really rely on you to pull the party through to the dawn. Fucking wild one, don't give the game away. But the powder dried up yesterday. Party boy, I know there's a party boy that's terrified of the party boy. Party boy, I don't like you. I know you know you don't mean to be a party boy. If I find you, if I catch you sniffing around my pride and joy, I'm sorry boy, but you can party at the bottom of the sea.
Today, we do not know what they want. They do not know themselves what they really want.
I've been wondering what that special place in hell looks like for those who promoted Brexit without even a sketch of a plan how to carry it.
Brexit means Brexit.
The Wire.
Taiwan's presidential election has been held over the weekend, and the incumbent president, Tsai Ing-wen of the Democratic Progressive People's Party, or DPP, has been re-elected on a record number of 8 million votes. She defeated her opponents, Kaohsiung Mayor Han Kuo-yu of the Kuomintang, or the Chinese National Party, and James Song Chul-yu of the People's First Party, who is running for president for the fifth time. For the past 4 years of her first presidency, Tsai held a strong stance against mainland China, as she refused to recognize an agreement reached between China's communists and Taiwan's former ruling Kuomintang that both sides belong to quote-unquote one China, with each having their own interpretation of what that means. That consensus is also known as the 1992 consensus. She ran her campaign by positioning herself as the protector of democracy and sovereignty of Taiwan against increasing pressure from mainland China, as Beijing reduced Chinese tourists going to the island and poached its remaining diplomatic allies. Taipei's legislative also passed a counter-interference bill, which criminalizes those who help, quote, external hostile forces organize political activities, disrupt social order, or lobby lawmakers at the end of last year. After William Wang Liqiang, a self-proclaimed Chinese spy who defected to Australia, alleged that China has been interfering in Taiwanese affairs. Hong Kong also played a part in the election, as crackdown on the pro-democracy protests only increased anti-China sentiment in Taiwan, giving Tsai, who has spoken of her support for protesters, a significant boost in support. Professor Tsai Jia-hong from the National Chengchi University in Taipei told me this election reflects a gap between younger and older generations, as supporters for the DPP are made up of younger people or university students who have a larger sense of identity of being Taiwanese than Chinese, and they are also much supportive of Tsai's progressive social policies, such as legalizing same-sex marriage, making Taiwan the first Asian country to do so.
I think young people educated with democracy and the they have very strong identity with Taiwan. So I think for most of the time, DPP or Tsai Ing-wen promoting democracy and Taiwanese identity. So I think young people, of course, young people don't like any corruption or any mishandling of important issues, but I think they really like democracy, freedom of speech, and they also identify themselves Taiwanese.
However, Han Kuo-yu of the Kuomintang is the opposite of Tsai. The populist mayor of the port city of Kaohsiung, which is located in the south of Taiwan, came to the national spotlight when he was elected as mayor at the end of 2018 in the local elections, as the city itself was one of the DPP's electoral strongholds since Taiwan transitioned to a democratic elections from authoritarian rule in the 90s. Calling for closer relations with the mainland to improve Taiwan's struggling economy, Han was supported by mainly middle-aged and older people who dubbed themselves Han Fans, or in Mandarin, Han Fen. Before winning the Kuomintang's presidential nomination, Han met with Chinese officials in Hong Kong to discuss trade and previously described Taiwanese independence as being scarier than syphilis and warned that another DPP presidency could lead to a, quote, volcano eruption in cross-strait ties. Professor Tsai also explained to me why the Kuomintang are more popular with older people rather than the young.
It's hard to say. If he can stay with Kaohsiung and try to improve his image, I think he still has some charisma, right? So I think, of course, he cannot let back and see what happens in the future. I think he really needs to work harder to get more trust from our people, but I don't see too many people pointing their fingers to him so far. So it's really hard to him. If he can make some progress in governance in Kaohsiung, maybe he can come back.
But for the Kuomintang themselves, they are now being seen as the party of pro-China. Does it mean in this election voters have rejected any form of politics that are too close to China?
I think the 10 KMT should think about kind of like a separation of politics and the economy. I mean, in terms of economy, I think nobody can deny that China is the big driver of world economy, right? So I think the KMT mayors or KMT legislators may want to keep working with Chinese government in terms of economy exchange, but in terms of politics, I think they really need to insist public of China, Taiwan, this kind of issue position. Otherwise, if they keep saying 92 consensus is applicable or possible, they may have difficult time to communicate with people. But if they can say, we have difference in politics, so we don't want to talk about it, but we still want to work with China to improve, for example, agricultural products or tourists from mainland China. Maybe they can work this out and regain some trust from people.
Apologies there. I mixed up the order of the clips for a little bit, but that was Professor Tsai talking to me that if Han Kuo-yu's life in politics is over and what the direction holds for the Kuomintang in the future. Because Han himself has announced after losing this election, he will return to his mayoral duties at Kaohsiung. But compared to his election in 2018, his vote share at his home has halved from 60% to 30%, and he is facing criticism for announcing his bid for the presidency only after being the mayor for 3 months. As well, he's also facing a recall campaign to remove him office. But now, here is the correct clip that Professor Tai explained to me why the Kuomintang are more popular with older people rather than the young.
So old people may have some experience back to Cold War, so they like to have better relationship between Taiwan and China. So when they see DPP, it's kind of, you know, not very good at negotiating with China. I think old people fear that there's going to be a war between Taiwan and China. And of course, yeah, old people also like to have more social stability and maybe some family values. But President Tsai is supporting same-sex marriage and encouraging diversity. So old people, right, they feel that, okay, our society may be breaking down, or maybe, you know, it's kind of generation gap may continue for a while.
Now, Tsai has been re-elected as president for another 4 years. China has responded by saying the DPP has used, quote, dirty tactics such as cheating, repression, and intimidation to get votes, fully exposing their selfish, greedy, and evil nature. While state media Xinhua Agency said Tsai's win was a, quote, fluke, and, quote, external dark forces were partly responsible for the election results, and the nationalistic Global Times had said, quote, the facts that the Chinese mainland is getting increasingly stronger and the Taiwan island is getting weaker is an inevitable reality, and recognizing and complying with the reality is the only feasible option for Taiwan's peaceful development. And out of this, what does the next 4 years look like for cross-strait relations between Taiwan and China and for Taiwan itself on the international stage? I talked about this issue with Professor Alex Tan of the University of Canterbury.
With regards to cross-strait relations, I do not expect a lot of improvement in that regard, mainly because Tsai Ing-wen and the political party that Tsai Ing-wen represents are definitely not the China-friendly party, so to speak. That's number one. China will try to impose a particular view of what Taiwan is, particularly with the so-called 1992 consensus, whether there's one country and what have you. But the DPP, the Democratic Progressive Party, and Tsai Ing-wen will not be too keen if that is the first thing that China requires with regards to improving cross-strait relations.
Apart from cross-strait relations, do you expect Taiwan's role in the diplomatic stage? As we have seen for the past 4 years, they have lost quite a significant number of allies because of China. Do you think would this phenomenon continue under the 4 years of President Tsai?
I think China would try to find many ways to try to squeeze the international space of Taiwan for sure. Whether you will see more diplomatic partners de-recognizing Taiwan, that's certainly a possibility. There's not a lot more left. There's about 15 left. Several of these diplomatic partners are under the American influence. So I don't think those are likely to recognize China as such. But of course, yeah, there could be some. I don't. There's not a lot left to begin with. But I think what Taiwan would see and what China may probably do is to limit its engagement in many international organizations, or make Taiwan's participation or even membership in several international organizations very difficult.
The Wire. I don't know, and frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te Wire Maurunga iri rangipoho. You're listening to The Wire on 95BFM, and that was me talking about the presidential election in Taiwan and what the re-election of President Tsai Ing-wen mean for the country and its relations with China and the rest of the world. We will be back after this. It's 911 Mr. Lonely by Tyler, the Creator.
Nothing without you shotgunning the passenger. I'm the loneliest man alive, but I keep on dancing and throw them off. I'm gonna run out of moves, cause I can groove to the blues. If you know any DJs, tell them to call me at 9-1.
I can't even lie, I've been lonely as fuck.
They say the loudest in the room is weak, that's what they assume, but I disagree. I say the loudest in the room is probably the loneliest one in the room. Attention seeker, public speaker, oh my god, that boy there's so fucking lonely. Writing songs about these people who do not exist, he's such a fucking phony. One thing I know is that I want to win so bad, but I'm not Chicago. Heart is low, it's real low, it's so low, you can't lift me up, I'm like a lotto. From the start, it's been real dark, it's been so dark, I guess that you could call it charboard. I'm playing like Hasbro, I'm really sorry, call me Auto. Crashed a McLaren, bought me a Tesla, I know you sick of me talking about cars. But what the fuck else do you want from me? That is the only thing keeping me company. Purchasing things till I'm annoyed. These items just filling the void. Been feeling it for so long, I don't even know if it's shit I enjoy. Current back door isn't that door. My partner is a shat door. I need love. Do you got some alcohol? Fuck it, I can find some tomorrow. But that never comes. Like a vasectomy, what have I done? I got the talent, the face, and the funds for myself long ago, but I haven't found someone. Mirror, mirror on the wall. The loneliest of them all. Cupid acting stupid, do you got another number I could call? Never had a pet, I never had a pet.
There's more fish in the sea, but I never had a goldfish to begin with. I never had a dog, so I never been good with bitches, cause I never threw a ball fetch. I never had a pet, that's where it stems from, I bet. Treat me like direct deposit, checking on me sometime. Ask me how I'm really doing, so I never have to press that 9. 1, 1.
That was The Wire.
And that is indeed The Wire for today, Tuesday the 14th of January. Thank you to all of you for tuning in, texted or called in. And thanks to my producer, Louis Laws, for his story on public media, and our news director, Lillian Hanley. And thanks to those who talked to us today. We got Paul Buchanan, Professors Tai Chi Hong, Alex Tan and Peter Thompson. Jin is here with the 124 next. Thanks for your company. Enjoy the rest of the week. Mate wa.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.